Welcome to the G&JB Show, episode number 54. Jack Bowen, how are we, mate?
I'm good, White Axe. How are you, mate?
Good, mate. We have an old friend of ours, Glenn Rushton, on the podcast today. How are you, Glenn?
I'm really well, Gareth. Yeah, it's great to be here with you and Jack.
Didn't need to say old, did you? Straight away, eh?
Mate, you said that. That wasn't me that said old.
Come out of your mouth, mate.
I tell you, Glenn was just telling us about a few of his old pets from back in the day in the Jurassic era.
That's so. Right, yeah, the Brontosaurus and the three horn, yeah.
Glenn, mate, we call this podcast Going Deep. So, mate, tell us about where you were born, where you grew up, and your early days before this crazy boxing world got hold of you.
Yeah, well, I was born in Bundaberg, actually, so... just in Queensland, my dad and mum, they were both born in Queensland, one in Townsville, one in Newenden. So, yeah, we're Queenslanders through and through. And I was in Brisbane probably till I was about nine, then went up to Townsville and did most of my youth up there. It's where I first started boxing up there with Reggie Kirkham, just behind the Pimlico High School, where I went to Pimlico High there. And, he's still... people have told me he's still going to this day somewhere up there, but he must be, I mean, I'm pretty old, so he's pretty damn old as well, Reggie. But, you know, we also trained up at the NFC, and one of the kids I went to school with there was in my class was Neil Patel. And Neil actually went on to be a very good amateur boxer and a good professional as well, Neil. So I actually ran into him when they inducted him in the Boxing Hall of Fame down there. Only a couple of years ago, so it was lovely to see him again, and he actually shares the same birthday as me, the 13th of August, so yeah, so that was a little bit of interesting history. That's where I first started boxing, of course, but I left home when I was 14, by the way. My dad was very benevolent. He gave me $20 and said, good luck, son, you know, so I left home when I was 14 from Townsville, and went down to Victoria picking fruit, so travelled all over the country. So I got out into the real world very, very young, and it's not that I was great at school. I was getting straight A's and, you know, really, really good at school, but just my brothers, two elder brothers, were out working and they had money, and in that era I just wanted money, you know, so I just wanted to be independent, and the opportunity came up with a half brother who said, look, I'm heading to Shepparton. I said, look, just throw me in the car, and he had $50, I had 20, and when we got there, we said, if we don't find work today, we don't eat tonight. That's how it was. So we got work picking fruit, and we got a draw, and we went and had a feed. So that's where I sort of kicked off, and until probably 74, when I was back in Brisbane by then, and I always was interested in obviously fighting. I did boxing for quite some time in Townsville, and of course Bruce Lee came out, as you know, and I just wanted to do everything Bruce Lee did, and that's when I got involved with Bob Jones in 1974. So I don't know, it's probably a little bit before your time, but he had a big dojo in Adelaide Street, all glass windows, and you drive down Adelaide Street and see all the guys there in white gis, and there was only a few options back in those days, and the others were very traditional karate, whereas when I walked into Bob Jones, they used to have a stage you could sit up on and watch the class, and I was sitting there, and there's a young Greek guy called George Roumioulidis. He was from Melbourne, but up in Brisbane, and he was pounding the living daylights out of this guy. There's blood everywhere, and he's got him bent over the stage, and I went, oh, this looks fair dinkum dish, you know, I've got to get into this, you know, so I joined up, you know, and I haven't stopped, so it's been over half a century of just combat sports since then.
So how old were you then, Glenn?
Look, 16, I think I joined, well, I went in when I was 16 and I turned 17 virtually. I was just waiting to get my license so I could drive in. So it was virtually the day I turned 17, I think I joined up. So it was within a couple of days of that I joined up and just went through all the belts in record time. And yeah, just there's so many fighters from that era that were just brilliant fighters. One of the guys that I fought in a tournament there, he's dead now, died last year, Jeff Else. He was a great boxer. He used to fight guys like Jeff White and all that in his day. You know, he's a really good boxer and a good martial artist. And look, we were all working on doors in those days too. You know, like there was any pop concerts come to town, Wood Mathers, Joe Cocker, Cassidy, you know, David Cassidy, Boy George, all these ones. Bob Jones did all that stuff. You may remember, you know, people like the Rolling Stones, and the stories Bob would tell us about you know, those fellows, you know, throwing TVs out of the travelodge from the 24th floor into the pool, riding their motorbikes up and down. He said the hallways, fire extinguishers up and down the hallways, he says, and the, you know, he said he'd have to go to the managers of the hotel and go, gosh, they'll pay for everything. They're just having a bit of fun. Those wild boys, yeah.
So you worked as a bouncer on the doors as well?
Look, I did. I worked for years on doors. In those days, it was so different to nowadays. You know, I worked one out on my own, you know, three bars. You'd have the private bar, the public bar, and the lounge, and you'd be managing the whole three, so you'd have a fight in one bar, and then you'd be just sorting that out, and there's another, hey, we need you in the public bar, another fight in there, yeah. So you run in there, and, you know, it was, yeah, like when you're working on your own, you don't have the luxury. You've got three or four people that you can carry one out, because then you go back to get the next one. Well, he walks back in, doesn't he? So,
yeah, yeah.
You know, it end up often coming to fisticuffs, and, you know, the manager of the day just said, mate, you do whatever you have to do. He said, just, these are the rules. And, yeah, we had rules like no colours in the place, and they had to have a dress standard, they had to pay their cover charge, and, yeah, we just had to enforce those rules. So they were wild, heady days. I worked at the Caribbean Hotel there for, you know, years, and the Newnham Hotel, and...
Was the Caribbean old bikies pub too back in the day?
Look, it was pretty rough. That's
yeah,
what I'll
right.
Say. Like, I think one of the bouncers who was working there before me, someone said they wrapped him up in barbed wire and dragged him around the car park there for a while. So, you know, it was. I know the manager said, "Are you sure you really want to do this?" But no, I was young. I was like 22, and I was a second-hand black belt, and I backed my skills, and yeah. I just said, "I'll work anywhere." You know, I'm not concerned about it. And yeah, we had some weird. We had one night a rifle was shot through the public bar. There's a bullet hole still in the ceiling there. And a truckie one night, you know, I was sorted out a situation, and I didn't like the way he looked when he walked out. So I followed him and stood at the door, and he got out, walked to his truck, and he pulled out this sheet wrapped up. He's got a rifle, you know, and he's walking back towards the hotel with this rifle, and it wasn't me that he wanted to shoot, it was the guy I was arguing with, and that's why I told him he had to leave. And he looked at me standing at the door, but I was quite polite to him. I just said, "You have to go because of the altercation." And he, as he looked at me, he's lifted up the gun, you know, and he's pointed at me. So I've jumped behind the brick wall there, and then no bullet went off. So then I put my head back, and he's still, now he's got the gun down, walking again. So then I've stood back in front of the, and he's done this two or three times, and he's getting close. And I said to that night, I had another guy, one of my other martial arts mates, was working with me. I said, "You go out the other door, go behind the cars. I'll sort of be the bait, and when he gets close enough, jump him from behind, just grab him, you know, get that gun off him." So anyway, he was positioned, so he'd bolted out, and I'm waiting for this guy to get closer, and I'm just looking at him as he's raised the gun. I'm just in my head like this, side to side, "Don't do it," sort of thing, you know, "Don't do it." And he's just looking at me for what seemed like eternity, but he had the gun down at this point, so I'm staying there. And he's just looking, and I'm going, "You're not quite at the point where my mate could grab him." So, and I'm just staring at him, and I'm shaking my head like, "Don't do it, mate." And then he eventually just turned around, walked back to the truck, threw the gun in, drove up the wrong side, over the traffic aisle in the semi, and I walked back in and said to this guy, "If I wouldn't have been here, you would have been dead. You come that close to being dead tonight." And he just laughed. He went, "Ah, garbage." And I went,
"Yeah, yeah."
Some people just never learn.
So. Didn't realise how close he was to, yeah, getting
Yeah,
that.
So we had a lot of interesting things like that. Knives, bottles, you know, you name it, guns. And it was just it was an interesting place, yeah.
And that's the start of Glenn Rushton's life.
And you were competing all through that time as well?
Yeah, I did all my competing in martial arts. You know, I won 5 national titles, 5 state titles, numerous other tournaments. So I did all my competing because when I was boxing, my dad would never sign the forms to allow me to fight. You know, he wouldn't sign anything. I never got any, if there was anything that you had to get done, he just wouldn't sign. You know, he just, "I'm not signing anything." You know, so just a strange way of looking at things, but that's the way it was. So I couldn't compete as a boxer. And I used to be a competitive swimmer as well, but I couldn't join the club. I went down, one of my mates was a great swimmer, Buchanan. One of the Buchanans went to the Olympics. I think it was Glenn. They were really good swimmers.
Yeah,
Glenn Buchanan. There was Glenn, there was Rodney, who was in my class at Currajong School, and there was Malcolm, his brother. And, you know, I won all my races, and But I never, you know, I did end up pursuing swimming for quite some time with aspirations to go to the Olympics in swimming. But yeah, at that point, and you know, so eventually, obviously, when I went to martial arts, I just fought. And Bob Jones used to run tournaments all the time, so we would have these tournaments, which were supposedly non-contact tournaments, but they were just bloodbaths. You know, the first six tournaments, I think I got my nose broken in every tournament.
In a non-contact.
Yeah, non-contact, of course. But I think I won most of those, I think five of them or so. But, you know, they were just great tournaments. You learn a lot. And I learned to move my head a lot. And I even say to this day, I say, look, it's really simple. Either you move your head or the other guy's going to move it for you. And it hurts less when you move it yourself.
Yeah, that's right.
They're your choices.
So what does a competition look like for what you were doing in martial arts?
Look, in martial arts, the tournaments in those days, the way we used to run them, is that you would just start with a big bunch. You might have, you know, 15, 20, and you just keep fighting down, 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 of course, you know, until you got the last two. Yep. And it was just a war of attrition. By the time you get to the final, you'd have one eye closed. And it's a little bit like if you've read Costa Zoo's book, and he says, you know, when he fought in the World Championships in Sydney in 2000, I think it was, wasn't it? And he said, by the time they got to the final, it was literally a war of attrition. You know, everyone's banged up, so it's survival of the fittest. And that's what it was like in these martial arts tournaments. You'd get to the final and people would be nurse and this injury and this injury. Yeah. And a little bit like Karate Kid, you know, when you see him.
Yeah, yeah, that. Yeah. That's because that's where my head goes.
That's where I was thinking. Like,
it's like, it was like that, you know. But, you know, in a one-day tournament, you could fight five, six, seven times in a one-day tournament.
Just, yeah, right.
You'd start with hundreds and you just work your way down. So,
Was it a combined rule of a lot of different martial arts, or was it just like karate, or because I know in the martial arts game there's a lot of different disciplines, I suppose. Yeah. What were these events? Was it a bit more like the, as we know, the UFC nowadays, or not really?
Yeah, not really. Karate's evolved a lot over the years, and when I started out, Bob Jones, because of the Bob Jones Karate Dojo was basically started by about a dozen bouncers. A little bit of brief history there is Bob trained with a fellow called Tino Sobrano, Kate Sobrano's dad.
Kate Sobrano,
And he was a Goju Kai guy, I think Hawaiian descent he comes from, but a great martial artist, Tino, and I've actually did a seminar with him. Someone said I'd sparred him. I've never sparred Tino. It was floating around the internet. It's just garbage. I never ever sparred Tino. I did do a seminar with him once, and yeah, we spoke a bit, and a real nice fellow, a lot of respect for him. So Bob was a first coup, ready to go for black belt. So you go through, there was 10 belts to get the black, then there's black, and you know, you go through the 10 dans after that. So Bob was one, he was ready to go for black, but the story goes that Tino wouldn't grade him the black belt because he knew he was just going to leave and set up his own martial arts studios. So then he just went out on his own anyway. It was first coup, which was a brown belt with two black stripes. So he was ready to go for black. He went out with Dave Berry, and there's a bunch of them, Billy Monet. They were tough, tough guys. Richard Norton was if you look at back in history, you'll see Richard Norton and Bob Jones were partners with Bob Jones, even though it was under Bob's name. Richard and all the security stuff with, whether it was Rolling Stones, Joe Cocker, Fleetwood Mac, was always Richard and Bob, and they did all the major security out here for international stars that came here. He was doing that.
Yeah, well, it's quite well known that you're quite successful in your own business, right? And I know you've done promoting in martial arts as well. Yeah. Which came first, your head into your business, or was martial arts always part of your business as well?
Yeah, both. I mean, as you know, the idea is to make your hobby, you know, or your passion, of course, your business if you can. And obviously, I know you do that yourself, and so does Jack. I always love combat sports. As kids, we were always naturally strong. We'd win all the arm wrestling competitions, you know, we used to love the old watching the world, you know, whether it was Professor Tanaka or Killer Kowalski. All these guys, we sort of love it. Of course, as kids, you go, oh, this is 100% real, and I'm going to get the sleeper hold on you. So, we loved all that as kids, wrestling, arm wrestling, anything that was involving strength. I mean, when I was pushing weights, I used to bench 170 kilos, so I was heavy into weights. So I used to push really heavy weights, and did my shoulder trying to bench 175 kilos. But so, we were into all that sort of stuff, but in... when it comes to business, I went into business initially when I was 18 with a brother of mine, you know, building houses in Townsville. So I sort of went into business early, then I went back into selling, then I went back into business. So I was always involved. I've been in business for well over 40 years. So I always said I was unemployable, you know, because I just like to do things my own way. And so I went into business and I ended up making, obviously, at one point I had 10 martial arts clubs. I was doing private lessons. I was promoting. I was just full time. And then I established the National Martial Arts League in the late 80s. And that wasn't, we're alluding to before, where we brought all the styles together, whereas with Bob, because he wasn't affiliated with FAKO, which was the Federation of All Karate-Do Organisations, okay. We used to watch those guys and go, oh, we could kick their butts, but we weren't allowed to compete in theirs. We had to fight in Bob Jones tournaments only, whereas I'd always regretted that, not having that opportunity to fight the best from every martial arts style around. And everyone wants to test themselves against the best. We all do. That's what I really get excited about in boxing, is going to places like, you know, whether it's Mexico with Dennis or Brooklyn or Vegas with Jeff and all that stuff. So in those days, I wanted that. And so when I introduced the National Martial Arts League, we brought every single style. We structured a set of rules that would work for all styles that were fair to whether it's Kung Fu, Taekwondo, didn't matter what it was. And it was brilliant. I mean, we ran it on... it used to be on Sky. We used to run it a couple of times a week on Sky. OB vans out at every event. We ran Brisbane, Sydney, Melbourne. We ran into state competitions, which we won. I captain coached the Queensland team to victory in that interstate. And we had just such good fighters in that. Some of them, like Paul Briggs, was in that. He was only, a youth in that age. Stephen Vick, Ian Jacobs, people like... all the best. Adam Watt, he was in one of the teams. Oh, yeah. He went on to be a good boxer as well. And I'm just mentioning some of the names here that have also gone into boxing. So all those guys, they, a lot of them cut their teeth in the National Martial Arts League, and we still reminisce about what great fighters we developed, because we're fighting all the time. Yeah, it was a league, so you're fighting. I used to run an event in Brisbane, then I'd go down to Sydney, then I'd go down to Melbourne, and sometimes it'd be strikes. I drove from here to Melbourne because they'd have all the out gear and stuff often, ran the tournament and then drove back, no sleep. Just drove down from Brisbane to Melbourne, ran the event at the Dallas Brooks Hall, turned around and drove back.
Mate, I'm interested in that, how you run those events. Like, what was your main source of revenue? Were you getting paid from TV to run that, or were you sponsorships, tickets? What other things will bring in your dollars through the door?
You know, it's interesting that I had other businesses going at the time. I was doing other things as well. I was a builder and developer for many years. I was an investment manager, as you know, for many years. So, yeah, I did have other business interests, but we did sink a lot of capital into the NMAL to launch it. And I had meetings with Porky Morgan and that about, I wanted to take this really big. And I still may again one day, because I finally perfected everything about it after running so many events. Come up with a set of rules that were absolutely breathtaking, and just the whole format of the thing was pretty dazzling. And some of the old footage I look back is still incredibly revolutionary. And even, you know, Sky and all of them, they were saying, look, you're 20 years ahead of your time, you know. But we were looking to run that in a very big competition, but we needed $20 million. And Porky Morgan, who, as you know, was very instrumental with the Broncos in the early days, and Barry Morant and all those boys. And he just, he was keen to get behind it and back it and make it happen, and he died. So that was a huge setback for us, and it was very unfortunate, because he was a mover and a shaker, you know. He was a massive mover and shaker. And, I had John Brown, not the ex-minister for sport, the other John Brown, who first introduced corporate boxers to the Tennis Open in Melbourne. He was working with me side by side. We just travelled all over the country, everywhere, trying to seek sponsors. And it was funny, because we had like the AMA and that saying, oh, it's too brutal and all this sort of stuff. And so we always had to battle. And of course, that battle continues to this day, you know, with head injuries and concussion and that argument. But at the end of the day, people like to compete.
Sounds like Dana White took your ideas, mate.
Yeah, well, we were ahead of them, way ahead of them. And what we did, I used to even watch the UFC in the early days, you know, where people would be punching the other guy in the groin.
Oh, that was brutal, wasn't it? Early, have you seen any videos?
I've seen some, yeah.
Oh, crazy, mate. Brutal. You just see a guy there just punching someone over and over into the groin. You're going, this is just nuts. So, you know, and I said, it's just going to bring more and more rules in. This is very embryonic. But, you know, it evolved. And I still think our concept was way ahead of its time. And as I said, there's still in the back of my mind that maybe one day we relaunch it.
So what was the stage like, as far as when I say stage, I'm guessing it wasn't a boxing ring. Was it a cage? Was it just matting? How big was the area? What was it? How did that work?
Look, we started out with just mats, but as we evolved it, we realised eventually we had to go to a ring, which we did in the end, only because we wanted to try and keep it on a mat. So it was a big area, you know, 10 square metres, it was big, but the problem, the danger was always there of people getting projected. Like Ian Jacobs, it was funny the first night he fought, because my team was called the Jets, and Stephen Vick, very competitive, went on to win.
Can I just jump in? Was it always team against team?
Yes, it was.
That is that how you did it?
Until we went to individual as well, and we had individual comps as well. But it started out as a team's competition over a season, a premiership, and you'd fight. And we when we run up here in one of the years, I think it was 1989, and Steve Vick was out scouting. Lovely guy. I caught up with Steve just recently, and you know, still think the world of Steve Vick, and he went on to win a world kickboxing title, very good martial artist. If you could see what he used to do with his legs, was phenomenal. Yep. So anyway, Steve was recruiting and he got this guy called Ian Jacobs. We'd never seen him before, and I put one of my guys up against him because he's got a new guy, and because coaches could recruit anywhere they want. Yeah, you were free. If you were a coach, you go and recruit the best martial artist. If you could find Bruce Lee, you find him, put him in your team. So it was open slather, and he put this guy in Jacobs, and I went, oh, new guy, don't know who will throw up. And I said to Adrian Steendam, he's dead now, killed in a motorbike accident, lovely guy, one of my black belts. I threw him in, Jacobs come out and hit him with a front kick, and he literally picked him up and just sprawled him out of the ring, right, landed at my feet. You know, and I went, get up, Adrian, gone in you go, it's just a kick, you know. he's looking at me like, and he got it back out again. Next time Ian comes out, big side kick. Here comes Adrian, lands at my feet again. And he says, who the F is this guy, you know? And I said, I don't know, but just get out.
Sounds like Street Fighter.
Oh, mate, it was brutal, you know. And I ended up fighting Ian in the final, you know, because it come down. Because we went through the whole season. They were called the Taipans. Our team was called the Jets. We were the only two teams out of all the teams who were undefeated. And when we met the grand final, it was just, it was war. They had an incredible team, so did we, and we went out, we were down 4-2, and then they put up Ian Jacobs, and I said, I just got to fight Ian. The only way we're going to win this is if I can beat Ian Jacobs, you know, and he was a killer, you know, and I beat him, you know, and then we won it. We won the grand final.
He would have been a bit younger than you two, I'm guessing, at the time, no?
Yeah, I was 32 or something. He was 18, so yeah, he was young and fit and as tough as teak.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I beat Ian, and the funny thing is we all went back to my place, and both teams went back, and we drank ourselves silly, and in the morning I said, you guys better get out of here, you know? But it was just an incredible event, you know, just amazing. So, yeah, great days.
What were some of your best attributes as a fighter, Glenn, back in those days? Like kicking, or was it striking, or...?
Yeah, look, my hands were always my strongest point, you know, but I did have brilliant takedowns, and one of the things that Ian said, I was so worried because I used to always take people down, you know, all the time. I mean, my brother, who was an Australian kickboxing champion, we always had a bit of rivalry. He's 2 years older than me, and he used to beat me up when we were kids in boxing, but he'd come back after I'd been doing martial arts, and I've touched him up and gave him a dusting down, so he had to join up then, and he wanted to be, so he went on to be a great martial artist. And we get to a seminar, and he'd been down boxing with Snowy Hill all the time. He said, oh, I've been going to Snowy Hill's, my boxing skills are really good now. And he was, you know, second Dan or whatever as well. And soon as, of course, I think it was Bill Wallet, Benny the Jet Ercades, he'd come out doing a seminar. He said, oh, we're going to do a bit of sparring, you know. So, of course, my brother makes a beat.
For you.
It was funny, you know. And he come in and he's, Yeah, just a bit of sibling rivalry, yeah, yeah. You know, and he's come in, and every time he got near me, I've just put him on his bum, boom, you know, big take, and boom. And he just couldn't get in to land that big left hook, because every time he'd get anywhere near, boom, he'd be on his backside. And after spar, he said, geez, those sweeps work well, don't they? You know, but no, just, so sweeps, yeah, they were one of a lot of takedowns and just dumping, because you could, if you could take people down and hit them within a second, you'd get a bonus point. You know, if you could kick them in the head, you'd get a bonus point. So there's an incentive to use spectacular technique. And you should have seen, like, some of the kicks. Stephen Vick, some of the footage we've got, just jumping, spinning, crescent kicks. It's like the best slam dunk you'd ever see. You know, to be able to jump, spin, turn, and put your foot and smack someone right in the head. And Stephen could do it with...
It was Street Fighter.
Oh, it was spectacular, you know. It honestly was. And so, no, we had some great stuff. And as I said, it was embryonic in a lot of ways, because Stephen, Ian, all these guys went on to become world champions. They all cut their teeth in there. Adam Partridge, as I mentioned before. And we had juniors, we had intermediates, we had women's, we had men's divisions. And, yeah, it was exciting days.
Were you putting up prize money or was it an amateur?
Originally it was amateur, and then we did start putting up prize money. But, you know, we had a vision there to obviously see people be very well paid. And, you know, I actually did consider doing a similar thing with boxing, and I started crafting a set of rules and things. And there's still a lot of things going on in the background here that, you know, can be done. But, you know, we'll look at that at a future time. But there are certainly possibilities, because I love all combat sports. You know, it doesn't matter what it is. And I trained with weapons, because when I was 19, I just, like, one thing that I haven't mentioned is probably instrumental on why I got into combat sports is when I was 12 years of age, I went to the Rising Sun Theatre in Townsville, and in those days, to go to the toilet seems again, a little bit Jurassic as we started out with here, but you had to leave the theatre, walk outside, walk down an alleyway, and they had these outside, these dingy little toilets outside. So it's in the dark in the alley, and then you'd have to get a pass out and come back in. So I went out, I'm standing at the urinal as a 12-year-old, and suddenly I just heard this commotion there, and these two little kids were standing with this adult usher, and they're going, it's him, it's him, it's him. And I'm going, well, I hadn't done anything. All I'd done is just walked out to go to the toilet. What I found out later is these kids probably rocked the roof and blamed me it, but they were the ones who did it, didn't they? The usher just walked in. He was a grown man, probably 35, and just smashed my head into the brick wall from behind, just going, boof, smashed my head, then grabbed me by the hair, dragged me out into the alley, and just punched the living daylights out of me, you know, and just... And I remember, you know, I went eventually, my mate come outside because he wondered why I hadn't come back in. I'm standing there all banged up, and he said, you know, he said, what do you want to do? And I said, well, he said, how about I double you down to the cop shop? You know, so we went down to the police station, I think it was at Munding Bar or somewhere there anyway. So he doubled me on his bike down to there, and the police wouldn't do anything. You know, they wouldn't do anything. They'd say, oh, you kids are always rocking his roof or whatever, and, you know, so forth. And I said to my mate, I said, this will never happen again. I said, I'm going to become the best fighter in the world. That was my goal. I said, I'm just going to be the best fighter. No one will ever do this to me ever again. And they never have. So I stuck true to my word, and I just studied everything I could, knives. And, you know, I used to have rifles as a kid. I just studied everything I could, whether it's grappling, boxing, fighting. So when Bruce Lee came along, eventually it was a no-brainer. It was just a no-brainer to go that way. So, yeah, so that's what sort of drove. And there's always a catalyst, because whenever people used to walk in, and I've trained thousands of men, women and children over the half a century, and always used to say, why are you here? What's your problem? What's happened to you, in other words? Because the ones that stay the longest are the ones who've been cut the deepest. Mm. You know, when something's happened that's very, I find, that hits hard, then there's like this... They say the guys that often go on to become incredibly successful billionaires is sometimes it's because they've been so poor as kids, they've just got this insatiable thirst that they can't quench. So it doesn't matter how much money they make, they still feel poor, but they've got to just make more and more. And I think the same thing sometimes with people that have had some, whether it's like Jeff with the bullying that come in to, you know, learn how to look after himself, you know, just got this insatiable thirst that they just, they want to feel safe. And that's why I stay really sharp to this day. You know, people, I've always said anytime, anywhere, any place, and fear no one. And, you know, you probably know of the little incident we had with Bone Mac over there. And I just walk straight up to him. Hi, Bone Mac. Glenn Rushton. How are you? You got a problem? Let's sort it out right now. You know, so no fear of anyone. And that's the way I want to live my life, is no fear of anyone or anything.
Did you see the guy later on, the security guy? Look, did you ever see meet face to face when you had a few skills?
It's funny because there's an interesting sort of little end to that story, but it never changed the emotional way it affected me. Is after the police wouldn't do anything, I went down to the Rising Sun Hotel and my brother was down there. Of course, it's funny because in those days you had to be 21 to get to the hotel, and he was, I think he might have been just turned 15 or 14 or whatever. So I dragged him out and he'd come down and he's still a kid, but he was a lot bigger. He grew early, I grew late, and this is the brother that I eventually was sparring.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I'm very, very close to, and Rob come down there and he confronted this guy. Rob's only, of course, 14, but he's a big, tough 14, you know. And he said, you know, he was going to bash this guy. And this guy was sort of all apologetic then to him.
He was backing down to a 14-year-old.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But he just come down and he had balls, you know. He really did. And he just come down and just said, you know, and he was toughy, you know. Like, he was very toughy, my brother. He was one of those sort of kids that, I remember once we're at the swimming pool and a kid says to him, he's looked over and, what are you looking at? And he said, oh, your ugly face. And he was just always quick with, you know, we'd say something like, he's got a headache. So, yeah, the head like that, no wonder it aches, mate. He was just always, you know, coming back with some cheeky stuff, you know, and getting into fights all the time. But he was tough, you know, and, yeah, he stuck it up him as a 40-year-old. They didn't actually fight, but he threatened to have a crack, you know, and he was, he backed down. So that was impressive, but it didn't affect me. What made me realise, and I keep saying this to people to this day, the only person that's going to be with you every second of the rest of your life is you. So you better become your own best bodyguard. Mm-hmm. I learned that the hard way. You know, you've got to be your own best bodyguard. And that's what I've always maintained.
Do you think that played into why you become such a good coach, Glenn, that you were able to identify those catalysts that maybe got people into the gym and you could work on that with them?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I always say to people at training, I don't care what you felt, I've felt it. You know, I say, I don't care what you felt, all the emotions, whether you win, whether you lose, you know, you're feeling down. I said, look, I've had black belts that they'll come in here one night and they'll walk out feeling like a white belt because they'll get dusted down. And then I've had white belts coming in some nights, they walk out feeling like a black belt because they've had a good night. And it's the same thing in boxing. You know, you might spar one day and you spar like crap and you go, oh, nothing's working for me, you know. And then a month later, it could be the other way around. Everything sort of clicked and working and you feel I could beat anyone in the world. And that's all these emotions that we have. Because as you know, it's all about self-mastery. It's the greatest opponent is never the other guy. It's always yourself. If you can beat yourself, you can beat anyone in the world. So it's all about self-mastery. And as we all know, you learn a lot about yourself in that boxing ring. You learn a lot about who you are, what you stand for, and so forth. And you develop that courage. You develop that resilience. And kids just aren't resilient enough, unfortunately, these days. You know, they have to learn that there's nothing wrong with failure. I always say to kids, look, if you're too weak to if you're not strong enough to fail, you're too weak to succeed. You know, and that's really important to understand. If you're not strong enough to fail, you're too weak to succeed. You've got to be able to fail and realise that failure is just, look, there's one way never to fail. Just don't do anything with your life. Don't do anything. Don't ever stick your neck out and you'll never fail. But, you know, if you feel strongly enough about yourself and you know who you are, it doesn't matter when you fail. You just go, look, and I used to say this to Jeff, when he'd lose, and remember that Jeff had 66 amateur fights and only won 48. So he lost 18, but we won the big ones, three national titles, quarterfinals at the Olympics, world champion, you know the story. So this is the key, and as I said, you've got to be able to take those failures and just go, I know who I am, okay? I know who I am. And you can't bully someone without your own consent. So all these things are very important lessons, and we learn a lot of this in boxing or martial arts. Mm. Resilience.
Right. So from there, when you started your... Sorry, I was going to go into your business, your other side of your business, but I wanted to ask, what sort of crowds were you getting in your events? Were you packing places out? Were you a couple hundred, couple of thousand? What was it?
We had anything from a couple of hundred to a couple of thousand. Yeah. They were the sort of numbers. Like, we packed Chandler out there, and it used to hold seat actually 1,497 in the theatre.
It still does, yep.
There you go. I still remember that number. Yeah. And we packed that place, on various occasions there. And other times we'd have like 500, sort of 700, 800. So we'd normally run somewhere between 500 and a couple of thousand at most of the events. But, it was a funny thing. I said to the media one day, like, guys, if you guys would just get behind us, we'd pack this place. Mm. They said, if you pack this place, we'll get behind you. And now I understand how it works. I do, and I've never forgotten that.
It's like they want you when you're up there, but you need to get there.
Yeah.
The same with, the boxing events that we've done and everything,
You just need to understand the game, that's it. And I didn't feel bad about them. I just said, thank you. I appreciate understanding that, and, we will do what we have to do. So, but it is, the I'll build it and they'll come sort of thing. So,
So when did you pull the pin on that sort of stuff? After Porky Morgan?
Yeah, that was pretty much when we had busted our gut and I had invested so much money all around this country. And, sometimes you drive down to Sydney and we'd run an event at South Leagues or the State Sports Centre. And, we had times, there's a lot of airline strikes in those days, and, often we'd fly, but sometimes we'd just have to drive. We couldn't had to be there, because I would, understand this. I was not only promoting the event, I was doing all the commentating. I'd do the preview before the event. I'd run out and we'd do that, and the OB van would be there. I'd do that, and then at the end of the night I'd do the wrap up. We'd do all that. So I was
fighting the main event.
I was fighting. I was commentating. I would go from, it would be hilarious, because I'd go from 1 minute I'm out there either coaching or sometimes fighting. I'd do both, captain, depending who we were fighting. If they didn't need me, so we don't need me to beat this team, but if we did, I'd be there. And so I'd fight, I'd coaching, I'd be commentating, I'd rip my suit and everything off, and I'd be out there fighting, then I'd back with my suit on again, commentating again. Oh. At the end of the night, I'm not only doing the wrap-up for the OB van to get that video off to Sky News, then I'd be packing everything up, and then we'd often be 3 a.m, we'd often drive into the Pancake Manor, and we'd sit in there and we'd go, just blew another 50 grand a night. They'd have nights you'd do well, but the, yourself as a promoter, then you'd have nights where you go, look, I'm working my guts out, and you're losing a lot of money, so it's expensive, and it's tough. But when you've got a passion, you just keep pushing along and pushing along. But we were close to raising huge. We had Fosters we were talking to, all these big companies that put in big money, but as I say, we just went, I think with what happened with Porky was probably the final straw that we said, look, we're just going to have to shelve this. I never ever said we're not going to, I just said we're going to shelve it. We did keep running a lot of individual competitions for years and so forth, but we didn't run it as big again because the budget was just too big. Yeah. And it just needed a Kerry Packer, to sort of inject that capital. And we thought we had it, and then we didn't, But never mind, that's one of those projects for the future.
Sounds like when we spoke speaking to Jeff the other day, he said, I haven't actually announced my retirement. So he's just it sounds like he was shelving it. Yeah. If the money's there, I'll jump on it.
Yeah. Yeah, and sometimes things, as you said, it's just, it's not always shelved, it's just, postponed. Yeah. So, there's a time for everything.
Yeah, and it's got to be the right time.
Yeah, absolutely.
So from there, after the promoting, obviously you were still doing other things at the time. I'm not doubting that you had other things going on as well as you're promoting your events. What did you sink your teeth into that when you backed off the promoting?
Look, I went full on into property development then. That's where I went into. I just did a lot of property developments and did exceptionally well at the property development, you know, did a number of developments there, and, you know, then went in as my son got older and he wanted to be an investment manager. I supported him and sort of changed direction. And I've continually done that. I said, if you lose the passion at something, change direction. Like these days, people have several careers. You don't have to start out as a carpenter or mechanic and die as a carpenter or mechanic. You know, if you tie to be a professional photographer for 8 years, for example, when I was younger, and I did that for 8 years, did a lot of aerial photography, hanging out of choppers and, you know, light planes and all sorts of fun stuff, yeah, and wow. I had my own lab and everything. So I did that for 8 years. I went into selling when I was 22 and become the number one salesman in Australia. I said to them very aggressively, I'll be your best salesman in this country within 6 months, and I did it in five. So I was happy that I was 44 sales executives for a big international company, and I was selling photocopiers and printers. So I sort of always been prepared to back myself, and I think you've got to, and I say the same thing to boxers, like you got to back yourself. You know, you can dream as good as anybody.
Yeah,
you know, that's what I said to Jeff. You know, greatness isn't a birthright, it's a decision of the will. You can choose to be great, but when you take that choice, you've got to do what great people do. Mm. You know, don't tell me you want to be great and then don't turn up at training, or don't want to do your run or whatever it is. So it comes with a price, of course, but I've always said you don't pay the price of success, you enjoy the price of success. You pay the price of failure. So it's just a different way of looking at things, you know. And as you know, perspective is everything. So I'll turn that off.
So Jeff's entering the ring.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. So, you know, and that is the key to it. It's just, it's always perspective and looking at things in the right way. And as I said, backing yourself. And, you know, that's something, as you know, with a boxer, it's one thing to have the skills. It's the other thing to truly believe in your skills and who you are and as a person. And do you deserve to be world champion? Because some people just don't, you know, people will find their level. They don't believe you can put someone up there. It's why when people win the lotto, most people who win the lotto end up broke within, you know, 5 to 10 years. Mm. So it's...
Phone's going again.
Yeah.
Jeff's about to walk out and fight.
Yes, I'll just quickly turn that off. I do apologise.
You're right.
Sounds gone.
You're right.
So you know, and that's really important. You see people who win the lotto or whatever, and within 5 or 10 years, they're broke. And it's been said that if you took all the wealth in the world and distributed it evenly amongst every person on the planet, within 10 years, all the same people would have the wealth back. Mm. So acquiring wealth is a skill. Boxing is a skill. Mm. But, you know, as I said, a lot of it is belief. You know, people win the lotto and 5 years later they're broke. Because one, they don't know, they didn't get the wealth through effort, so they didn't learn how to acquire wealth. They were just given wealth. Mm. And you heard Robert Duran famously say, you know, and I'm sure you've heard the story, that he earned a huge amount of money, like massive amount of money. But they say that 90% of it, he says, went on women and alcohol and gambling. And he says, the other 10% I wasted.
That's right.
You know, so that's his story. Yeah. So it just goes to show that, and as Bob Arum said, he said, look, you could give Roberto Duran, he says, $100 million, he'd be broke in a month. You know, and I think the world of Roberto Duran. In fact, he said to me just before Jeff's fight at the luncheon, I said, do you think Jeff, I just want to see what he'd say, can beat Manny Pacquiao? And he said, why not? And I thought, I like that man, you know. Mm. I like that guy. I just love the way he thinks. And that's exactly what I said to Jeff too, you know. Why not? We can do this. You know?
Speaking of Roberto Duran, he actually, because Shane Mosley Jr. trained at our gym during that time, through obviously when Jeff fought Manny Pacquiao.
Yeah.
And obviously Damien fought on that day, and so we built a bit of a relationship there.
He fought David Toussaint, Shane Mosley.
He did, yeah. And Toussaint had it was a huge day. We've spoken about this to a few of our guests. I think it's Australia's biggest sporting achievement. I don't know what anyone throws at me. I just don't know if it can be topped, because as far as the public's eye, I know you guys thought you'd win. 99% of other people thought, well, he just can't. We want him to, but we just can't.
Yeah, exactly.
Mate, can you give us a bit of insight into the whole making the deal? Can we do this? Obviously, your dealings with Dean and the other promoters and Top Rank, and just so we get a bit of maybe information that we haven't heard about that fight before.
Well, it actually, when you look at what happened there, you've got to wind the clock back. When Jeff fought Cesaire the second time down on the Gold Coast at the casino there, and that was for a regional title. And Jeff was a little bit concerned about fighting Cesaire again, even though the first time they fought, he'd won both the first rounds. Cesaire gets cut in the third round, so we win the right to fight Colomb, and we all know Jeff knocked him out in 78 seconds. So we know what happened there. But then we had to, I said, Jeff, we must do this fight again. It's a blemish on your record. Let's fight Cesaire again. This time you're going to beat him very convincingly. So Jeff said, OK, if you think I can do it, I can do it. Okay, so, and it was great the way Jeff used to think in those days. He didn't watch any videos, he didn't look at the, he just said, you just tell me what to do and I'll do it. Simple as that. And I said, fantastic, I'll do the study, I'll create the strategy. I did that all the time, right up to and including Pacquiao. So when we sat down the next morning, because Dean Lonergan came over to watch that fight, he said, can I have breakfast with you in the morning? I said, sure.
So you're a free agent at this time?
Free agent at this time. I'd looked at a lot of different contracts and things, but I wasn't happy with any of them. So free agent. Sits down in the morning with breakfast. And I said to Dean, Dean, before we get started, I just want to tell you this. I see Jeff Horn fighting at Suncorp Stadium for a world title in front of more than 50,000 people. I can see it in my mind. I see that. Dean, if you can't see that, I'm going to get up now. And I went to get up. I said, I'm going to leave. Because he hesitated. He went, oh. And I said, Dean, if you can't see that, let's end this right now. If that's not where you're going, and he went, just sit down, he said, just sit down, he says, you know. And he said, look, okay, he says, maybe eventually. I said, no, that's where I'm going with Jeff Horn. That's what we're going to do. And he's going, oh, you know, you got a big dream there, you know. So that's actually where it started. And Dean will tell you the same thing. So it was basically me saying that was my vision, just as I said to Jeff, before he had his first fight, what I was going to do. I'm going to get you the Olympics in 4 years, and 4 years after that, I'm going to make you world champion. And he said, do you really think I can do all that? I said, I really believe I can do all that. And then we went on we went. So, and I do have these.
Out there dreams?
I do, yeah. Very realistic dreams. I've actually dreamt the day I'm going to die, by the way. And that happened when I was in my early 30s. So, yeah, very vivid dreams, very strange dreams, and sometimes, and I said this to Dean, so anyway, that's where we went. So leading up to that fight, I said to Stuart Duncan, the late Stuart Duncan, bless his heart, think the world of Stuart, but I said to Stuart, after we'd been negotiating, and he's the matchmaker, and he said, well, okay, let's talk about opponents. And I said, this is the deal, Stuart. What I want, guys, opponents must have had at least 20 fights. They've got to have a 90% win record, and they must be well-drained. That's my benchmark. That's what I want. He said, are you crazy? I think he said effing crazy, by the way. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, most trainers don't want to fight anyone with a pulse. Mm. And he says, you want all these tough guys? And I said, yes, I want all these tough guys.
How many fights had Jeff had by the stage? Sorry, Glenn.
Nine.
Nine, okay.
And I said, like, we'd already beaten Ben Robert, and that was a very interesting fight. After the first round, Jeff was pretty banged up, and his dad was in the corner, and I said to him, I think you better leave. You know, he wasn't handling it at all well. That was the first and last time he was in the corner. But I just said to Jeff, look, we've got to do this, we've got to do that, we've got to fix that, and then Jeff won every round after that. So, you know, we turned the corner. But this is belief and making the right decisions and making the tough calls. You know, and there's always a lot of moving parts. And I know I've copped a bit of flack sometimes on decisions I've made, but I'm big enough to handle, take the good with the bad. And sometimes people will swear by you, and sometimes I'll swear at you. If you can't handle that, then don't be in the corner. It's as simple as that. As they say, if you can't swim, stay out of the creek. Yeah. So that was... So when we went into that fight, by the time we got to Pacquiao, Jeff was actually the number one contender for both the WBO and the IBF, because we'd fought 11 world-ranked fighters. You know, like, we'd earned our stripes. So we were sitting there, it was a good position, and after Feneca, we thought we were going to get either Bradley or Vargas. And Dean said to me, look, you beat Bradley or Vargas. I said, look, Bradley's a tougher fight. Vargas, no problem. We can beat Bradley, I said, but that's a hard fight. He's a good boy. And he said, so you're happy to fight either of them? And I said, yep, this is after beating Feneca over in New Zealand. We're number one with both sanctioning bodies, both intercontinental titles. I said, yep, happy to fight. He said, you beat them, you get Pacquiao. I said, bring it on. Yeah, we're ready. Mm. Anyway, he rings me back about a few weeks later. How would you feel if you went straight to Pacquiao? And I just said to him right then, done.
I was going to say,
you don't want to think about it?
Yeah.
Done. Lock it in. He said, you're sure about this? I said, look, it's do it. I said, we're in. Okay, mm. We can out Pacquiao. I said, Pacquiao. Mm. And I don't know whether Dean really knew what I was talking about when I said that, but yeah. You know, that's and that was how it happened, you know. And then we just went from there, and as you know, we were on again, off again. Jeff and I did that big tour up in North Queensland and going to everywhere up there, and we basically got delayed, but then it was on, and total belief all the way through. I had no doubts whatsoever in my mind. I said to Jeff just before the fight, we're at a fork in the road. I said, Jeff, one fork leads to fame and fortune and incredible success. The other one leads back to mediocrity. I said, and you can take either road. It's just up to you. Just tell me which road you want to take. And he said, I want to take mediocrity, in his typical Jeff, joking way. And then he laughed. He said, no, of course not. And I said, no. I said, just want to be clear, because you have this choice and it's going to affect the rest of your life. Right now, you must choose to win. You know, and he did. You know, and you probably remember at the end of the ninth round, he's saying to the referee, Mark Nelson, when he come over and he said, look, I think he's had enough. That's what he said.
Give him one more. Yeah.
And I looked Mark Nelson in the eye and I said, do not stop this fight. I commanded him.
Yeah.
I said, you watch the video, you'll see it. I said to him, we're winning this fight and we can still win this fight. Do not stop this fight. That's when he said, well, you better show me something. And then the rest is history, what happened after that. So,
Did training change? Did anything for that preparation of that fight? Or did you just keep going as you had done previously?
Look, things change. You know, you're a boxer, you're a great coach as well, and you know, you understand all these things. So I studied Pacquiao every which way but loose. I eventually come up with the famous 10-point plan, and I listed 10 key points we had to do in order of importance to win that fight. And I said to Jeff, and remember, Jeff wasn't studying any video, nothing. He just, same as he'd always done, you tell me what to do and I'll do it. And he did. And I just said, this is what we got to do. I brought in Cesar Amonsod, who was in those days, he was really good in those days. I mean, yeah, he's getting on now, Cesar, lovely guy. But, you know, in those days, he was sharp. And I had him and we were paying him every week, you know, to spar. And, you know, so he was about the closest I could get that was freely available to do the rounds. But no, I had a plan and a strategy that I formulated after a lot of work. I really, really looked into everything and who I thought actually had the biggest impact. And if you look at Marquez, I looked very carefully at how Marquez fought Pacquiao, because they fought four times, always very close, very competitive. So I gleaned a fair bit from Marquez, but I also looked at other opponents that went wrong, people like Ricky Hatton, where he became predictable, left himself exposed, got knocked out. So I looked at the good, the bad, and the ugly, and really looked at formulating a strategy that would work, and it did work. So we got the job done. And once again, Jeff backed himself, I backed myself, and we said, you know, screw the odds, you know, and as I always say, the impossible are just things that haven't been done yet. Doesn't mean they can't be done.
Mate, I'm yet to hear it. Hopefully I will. What's it like being in when you hear and the new?
It's one of those phenomenal moments. Yeah, you just feel that sort of, that massive feeling that goes through your body. You know, as you know, when you get to a really big crowd like that, like 50,000, 52,000 people, it just permeates your body. It's like, you know, when you go to a rock concert and you're just there and it's just going through you. It's just going through you. And that's sort of how it felt that day. And when they said new, it was, just total euphoria. It's like everything that you've worked for. It's like time stands still and everything goes in slow motion for a moment. And that's sort of how it sort of feels. It's like when you're in the zone. And it was just one of those euphoric moments where you say to yourself, and I always do this, when things happen, I've had a lot of these moments in your life, I'll never forget this moment, you know, because we live for the moment. And they say a lifetime's not much, but it's enough if we live well. And that's why I always look at it. It's enough if we live well. And you know, it's on the mirror in my gym. It says every second counts. That's not just a metaphor for the boxing ring, but it's a metaphor for life. Every second counts.
I remember Freddie Roach you did the hands, and then once he'd finished, he complained about the brown tape or something. And I remember a couple of your guys, maybe it was Dundee or somebody, has anyone got any white tape? And I had some, because obviously I was there with Damien, gave some white tape, and I think you had guys had to start again. Well, there's a lot of dirty tricks played prior to the actual fight happening, or was that
100%?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. It wasn't just the tape. Mm. Steve Edwards, who was, I actually did the cuts right up to and including that fight. But after that fight, I let Steve start doing the because he always wanted to, and we slowly sort of groomed him and so forth. But I actually did all the cuts for that fight, so I was the cut man and the number one coach, second in that fight. But Steve had tipped 50 of the little vials already, ready to go, and then they made him throw it out because he said, no, you got to do it out at the ring. So there was all these little tricks, and that is, you crack 50 of those. Jeez,
50 is a lot too.
I know, you cut yourself off and open. They're 1 mil vials, yeah, as you know. So, I've got the bigger ones now, of course, but, and this is a thing. So there was a lot of tricks, and like Ben Horn nearly, because it was funny, because I go really good with Freddie now. You know, I like Freddie. You know, we went over and did a lot of sparring with Dennis Hogan, with Jesse Vargas at the Wild Card Gym. And he was perfect gentleman to me, so, a lot of time. But, he was doing his thing there, and, it was nearly a blue between him and Ben, because he's going, shut up, punk, you want to go, punk? He's saying to Ben, you want to go, punk? You know, and Ben's a bit toey, as And I'm going to Jeff, breathe, just breathe. Don't you get caught up. You know, that they're trying to unravel us. Mm. I'm not unraveled. You stay cool. Let them, and I just said, Ben, cool it. Just cool it. Okay, Freddie, you want us to use the white tape? We'll use white tape. Have you got any? Yeah, and I think I still owe him 6 rolls of white tape. And damn, I hope it's not accumulating interest. Yeah. But anyway. So we used the white tape. We tipped out all the adrenaline, and, we just... But, people do things to unravel you. You know, there's a lot of tricks in boxing, and, whether they're knocking on your door at 3 in the morning or whatever it is, there's a lot of tricks go on, and you just need to be street smart.
I was going to ask, was it worse for the Crawford fight?
I was going to jump on that too.
As far as the tricks?
Yeah. Look, there was a lot of things went on there, but, and as I said to Jeff, that yes, they did, the whole Crawford team. Again, look, I really like Crawford. One of the things I like, I used to say to people, I wasn't brought up, I was kicked in the guts and told to get up, and, we sort of brought ourselves up as kids, mother left and we're only 3, and, we sort of brought ourselves up. So it was a different life, and I just respect the grit and the toughness of Crawford. I like that. I like that toughness, that life experience that he's got. So I do respect the whole team, but it was funny because, look, when Crawford pulled out the first one and he was saying a bruised hand or something, I think I called him a princess or something. It's just all fight talk, as we're all trying to sell a fight. And really, but when we got over there, there were things, Bo Mac was apparently, I think I called him Big Mac or something, again, we were just having a bit of fun, it's just banter, Michael's the raffer and stuff, but Michael and I are good, we're good, we're good mates, so there's no problem with all this stuff. And it was funny because then he was going to meet me at the airport and bash me, and then he was going to bash me soon, then he was going to, after the fight, he was going to come and snot me and all this sort of stuff, And that's why, as I said, when I got there, as soon as I walked in, he was sitting in the room there, just it's like a VIP room or whatever there. I walked in, is BOMAC sitting there? So I thought, I'll get straight on the front foot, straight up. G'day, BOMAC, Glenn Rushton, how are you? And I thought, just this is your chance. Draw your gun. And I thought, don't do it because I'm just going to bang, because...
I'm ready.
As I said, I've never backed away from a fight, so it was never going to concern me. But anyway, we're good mates, and I have a lot of respect for BOMAC, what he's done with Terence Crawford, and I have a massive amount of respect for Crawford. I think he'll beat Errol Spence, actually.
And you think that?
I do think that. I just can't wait for that fight, but I really do. I just believe Crawford is a more complete boxer.
I got Crawford as well for that fight. That's going to be a cracker, though.
Glad
they got it over the line. Yeah, I know.
Oh, look, it's what everyone wants to see, the best against the best, and that's the one thing I think that UFC do a little bit better than boxing. The problem is everyone tries to protect the O. They all try to protect their boy and their fighter and so forth. But the people, the crowd just want to see the best against the best. And that's what I always want to see. If I was promoting, that's what I'd be focused on, the best versus the best. Cut all the crap.
I think a lot of the boxers feel that way too. Like I know, just coming up in the amateurs, every weekend you'd fight the best.
Yeah.
After you had 15 fights, you have to fight the best anyway. So yeah. There was no point dodging it.
No, that's right. And that's what you want. You know, to me, whilst money's important, and I've been very successful through a lot of businesses, we're all going to die broke. You know, we ain't going to take any of it with us. You know, the only thing, my philosophy is the only thing we take with us is what we leave behind. In other words, how many lives did we positively impact? That's why Jeff and I are very passionate about what we're doing with Bullyproof Australia. You know, we want to protect every student, every teacher, every school, everywhere. You know, it's a massive vision. But as I say, these are the things that we want to do. We want to change the world. But as I say, if you want to change the world, start with yourself and let the ripple effect take over. So, you know, we realise to make these impacts, that's what we have to do.
Next up, was that Anthony Mundy next?
Look,
After Crawford,
and a couple of things that we didn't mention there was poor old Stephen Edwards was getting out of the lift and he had this Hornet shirt on, and one of the guys said to him, what, mate, you got shit on your shirt. And Stephen, being pretty, he's pretty sharp, Stephen, he said, mate, you got shit in your mouth. I thought that's a good one. Stephen. I thought,
was that in America?
Yeah. He did well. He was in the lift, he said, you know, and this guy said that. I went, no. But yeah, they were before the fight. They're sort of standing behind the wall, going take over, banging the wall. They were in the dressing room. You know, we had Mark Wahlberg come out there, and he's having a chat to Jeff and I in the dressing room, and they're at the wall, going take over, and banging the wall. Look, they really tried to undermine us, but water off a duck's back. There is no way in the world they have any chance of undermining us. Not at all. Jeff still could have won that fight, and it breaks my heart that he didn't. But yeah, the day before he couldn't even walk. He had massive blisters. I was squirting. I nearly got myself in the eye. Actually, squirting. Just huge blisters on his feet. His hands were killing him. There's reasons for it, but yeah, it is what it is now. But yeah, it's such a shame. A lot of those rounds were really close. What's that fight back? They were close rounds. A lot closer than people realise. So it was actually a good fight. But it is what it is. And as you said, Mundine. That was an interesting.
Was that the next one?
Look, I think after Crawford it was Mundine.
Yeah.
Well, that was an interesting fight with Mundine, and he's a real character. I like Anthony a lot, you know, and a lot of negotiations. I think I got the upper hand there because Ahmed Dib, and I got to take my hat off to Ahmed. I met his brother, Billy. We had a coffee recently down in Melbourne. Lovely guy. He's been through a hell, poor Billy, and wonderful, wonderful man. But Ahmed is also a lovely guy. And we sat down negotiating this, and I'd heard stories of Anthony going on drips and sort of putting on 8-9 kilos like from the weigh into the fight, things like this. And I said to Anthony, what weight can you make? Because he wanted middleweight, and we wanted welter and stuff. So we're arguing about weights, where we're going to fight it. And I said, what weight do you reckon you're going to walk in on the night? I guarantee, he says, that I won't be over 75 kilos. I said, you're sure about that, Anthony? He says, I absolutely guarantee it. I said, good, I'm going to make that a condition of the contract. And I did. And poor old Anthony was paranoid about it because I put these massive penalties in the contract that was going to cost him like 100,000 per 100 grand or whatever. He was over, and he was just...
So was it middleweight? It was...
He couldn't come in over 75. Yeah, so over 75.
What was the official
weight? What was the official weighing day?
I think, look, I have to go back and look on the record, but I'm not sure whether there was a catch weight or whether it was a middle. I think it might have been middle. I'm not sure. Yeah. I think it was middle we agreed on, but then on the night, I had a second weigh-in on the night that he had to do, and he couldn't be over 72.53 for middle, but he couldn't be over 75 on the night. And that was the one I want, because I didn't want him coming in on the night at 82 kilos. I didn't want that happening.
Yeah.
So, that's where I was a bit concerned. That was a massive, big jump. So, yeah, we resolved that. And as you know, what happened there, look, people said that he took a dive. He didn't take a dive. I was sitting ringside there. And when you see someone's head bounce off the canvas, it's just instinctive. You always tuck your chin in. Any fighter does. His head just went boom. I knew he was out cold before he hit the ground in that fight. And you know what's very funny about that? This is a behind-the-scenes thing that people wouldn't have heard. The day before they rang me, I'm trying to think who rang me. One of Anthony's team rang me and said, he's walked in the ring just after they'd set up the ring, right? Anthony's got up and moved around the ring and he said, and it's too soft. He wants your permission to reduce the padding of the ring, halve it. So instead of whatever the mats were, he wanted to halve that, and he wants your permission because the guys here won't do it unless you agree. And I said, he's not testing it properly. And they said, what do you mean? I said, tell him to fall back onto his head and see how it feels. Because that's what's going to happen in the fight. See, I've said so many prophetic things, it's crazy. Mm. And they laugh. And I said, no, I do not give you my permission to change the padding in the ring because I think it's unsafe for Anthony. Mm. Now, who knows what could have happened if they would have had their way? And who knows? Because he did fall, like I said, straight back and landed on his head. He bounced off that floor. And, yeah, in a minute or so, he'd come to as okay, but you don't get a minute, do you? You get 10 seconds. Mm. So, but that was just one of those little behind-the-scenes things that, yeah, people wouldn't be aware of.
As you said, people said, did he take a dive? He's too proud to dive. No. He wouldn't. There's no way Anthony Mundy would ever take
a
dive.
He's a warrior.
And he'll own that. He'll own that, you know.
Absolutely. He's a warrior, you know. No, a lot of time for Anthony, so incredible athlete.
Mate, and then Jeff's last fight, as we know it so far, was Tim?
Yeah, Tim, yeah.
How was the build-up, everything for that?
Zarafa fight.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the second one, Zarafa fight, you know, was one of those fights. I said to that, look, Jeff was humming and hawing about whether he wanted to accept the rematch. Mm. And I said, you just got to do this, you know. And it was at middleweight.
And was Jeff thinking he was done? Or?
Oh, look, he just didn't really want to fight him again. Yeah. And I just said, you've got to do this, Jeff, you know. And by the time he hummed and hawed, we had like 6 weeks left. Time. It was only 3 months to exercise that rematch. And, of course, you know, I had Brendan Burke come and saw me and was trying to get us to release him out of that, you know, so we could fight, you know, another fight. And I just said to Brendan, I'm sorry, no, you know, we're going to do the rematch. So that's the way it worked. And Jeff didn't want to do it. Finally, he agreed. Yeah, I said, Jeff, you've got to do this. And I just flogged Jeff for that. I had 6 weeks to knock him into shape to turn that around. And I just sat him down there in front of the screen. I had the Pacquiao fight on one screen and I had the Rafa fight on the next one. I said, Jeff, who's this guy in the second fight? That's you. That's not you. You know, and I said, and he's gone and he's looked at it and back at it and he's gone, yeah, I'm nothing like it, am I? I said, no, but if I get you back anywhere close to that, we can win this fight. And I flogged him every time in sparring. I was pushing, I was shoving him, I was going, move this, that, you know, show me the mongrel, and just really pushed him and flogged him to get him back into shape. And a couple of incidents sort of went against us in that camp still. And by the time we got just before the fight, I said to Matt, I looked at him last spar, I said, we got 8 good rounds and 2 ugly ones. I said, gee, I hope we get him at 8. As I said to Matt, I said, we've got 8 good rounds in us and 2 ugly ones. And that's exactly how it worked on the night. First eight rounds, Jeff just smoked him, as you would see. And, yeah. And even Michael says, who the hell is this guy? Mm. Just couldn't hit him. Who is he? Completely different fighter. But then he got a little bit tired when Michael threw everything at him in round 9. And that was quite hilarious because there's corners going, throwing the towel, and unbeknown to me, one of the corner guys is passing the towel around behind my back. And I said to Ben, do not throw that towel in. I said, I will make the call. And Ben said, hey, I'm with you. He says, I'm with you. Don't worry about it. I'm with you. And I said, thanks, Ben. I appreciate it. And I really do appreciate that. You know, and then you saw what happened there. Everyone thought he was gone, just like in Pacquiao. Yeah. Everyone thought he was gone. But Jeff, just what I wanted him to do in the first Zarafa fight is I knew he'd come in real, like he did, step to the left, throw the overhand. Boom, he did this time. Boom. That's what I wanted him to do in the first fight. Did this time. Bang. Down he went. God, down he went again, of course. So incredible fight. Great comeback. That was incredible. But as you know, he just didn't prepare, unfortunately. The hunger was gone for Zoo. That wasn't Jeff Horn in that fight. That was not Jeff Horn. He trained like a corporate boxer for that fight.
Did you really?
Look,
I heard news of you saying, not exactly that, but yeah.
The basic truth is Jeff will take ownership of this one day. I think the world of Jeff. We still work side by side, and we will for many years to come. But he did come to me that time, said, "This time I'll do it my way." And I said, "What do you mean my way?" This was like 8 weeks out. And he said to me, "Oh, I don't want to do any hard sparring at all. He didn't do virtually any running at all either, you know. And I just said, Jeff, it won't work. I'm telling you, it won't work. And I said, no, I won't be responsible. And he said, oh, I think it will. And I said, Jeff, it won't work. I'm telling you, you know. That's why I'm the coach and you're the boxer. But anyway, so he had a crack at it his way. It didn't work, you know. So, but, you know, but the hunger.
Was he hurt? Was he carrying injuries, or he just didn't want to do it?
The hunger wasn't there. If you look at his mindset, it's the only time in his career I've ever said, Jeff, what are you going to do? And the only reason I said that is there's getting a little bit of interaction from the corner. And one of the things I've said, a corner is not a committee. And I don't say this in any way to be an egotist, but it is a dictatorship. You've got to have a chain of command, just like in the military. There's a chain of command and somebody has to make the tough call. And that someone has always got to be the person that knows all the moving parts. In other words, it's like in a company. Who is the best equipped to make that decision? That's all it is. It's not ego. Yeah. Who's the best? Who's got the most knowledge? And no one knows Jeff better than I know Jeff. No one knows him as well as I know him, you know. Save Joe, his wife. But I'm talking from a fighting perspective here. So I said, but look, the hunger wasn't there. When I looked at him, I said to Jeff, you know, do you want to go? And he just shrugs his shoulders. And the answer's right there.
Yeah, that's the answer.
Just right. Like, it was just indifferent. You know, it was just like when in his heyday, Jeff would have gone up there, hey, look, one hand, one leg, you know, it would have been like the Black Knight in Monty Python. Just a flesh wound, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, the hunger wasn't there. And I don't, look, when the hunger's gone, the hunger's gone. It's as simple as that. Fighters like taxis, you got to run them hot. You run them hot. And the biggest danger, and I hope Jack takes note of this, when you become world champion, instead of fighting every 2 or 3 months, it often becomes only a couple of times a year. Trying to organise these big fights takes time. If you don't stay hot, stay in that gym training, you have too long a break. When you come back into the gym, everything hurts. And you don't want to do it. It's like going back to work after a 3-month holiday.
Yeah.
It's hard. So the key is stay hot, stay in the gym, keep training. And if you do that, your career will last as long as your hunger lasts. But if you start having these extended breaks, you're going to get injury after injury and it'll be too hard.
So on Jeff's lesser nights, or the ones that he didn't win or didn't, let's say he didn't perform as up to his potential, was it all down to just self-belief wasn't there on the night, or and hunger?
No, I think with Jeff, Jeff, we worked it the way we worked for his first, right up until after Pacquiao, was fantastic. He just, as I said, you tell me what to do, I'll do it. It was the same in the corner. He'd sit down and he'd look at me, and it was just like I used to say this, I'd feel like I'm talking directly to his soul. Yeah. Like you could communicate, he would just be relaxed and open-minded. But again, the problem when you get to the top again is, I've always said to boxers, keep your feet on the ground and your head in the clouds. I said the same to Jeff. In other words, stay grounded, okay? Yeah, back yourself, but you don't want to become a legend in your own mind. You've got to be very careful that you stay very grounded, because we're always only one punch from hitting the deck.
Yeah.
They all go down. They all go down. Simple as that. So you've just got to be very mindful of that. And, I just feel that once he beat Pacquiao, things did change. Just remember Rocky and, when he's there getting all the faders and old club of lambs out the back. You know, like that's sort of what happens. And you're just too much time. Yeah, you're winning this award and that award. You're at the ESPYs. He won the Dom Award. It's wonderful that he got to have all those experiences and I'm incredibly happy for him, but it does take its toll.
Yeah.
It has an effect. There's time when you should be the club of Lang in the gym, okay, with a mongrel, and instead you're out there, getting photos taken and signing autographs. So, it takes its toll, and unfortunately it's going to have an impact on you. So these are sort of things that happen, and sometimes the hunger goes because, you're not in the gym and so forth. But, he did the impossible. He beat the fighter of the decade, and what he's done for boxing and what he's done for people to just instill that spark, that belief that, look, if Jeff can do it, maybe I can do it too.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm really, really thankful for, is that we've seen the George Kambosos, we've seen the Tim Zoos, and we've got all these other young, hungry boxers that he lit a spark in them, and that's all it takes is a spark to start a bushfire, So if that can become a raging inferno for these young guys, then Jeff's achieved in a huge amount. And what we will do over the next 10 or 20 years with Bullyproof Australia is going to change the direction of youth in this country. So, you know, I'm excited, and look, it's been a wonderful ride, and as I said, memories that you just can't take away.
Well, on that, I think that's a great point to finish, mate. That was absolutely excellent, learning the life of Glenn Rushton. Jack, I'm sure you agree.
Yeah, learned a lot of things I didn't know about you as well. So, yeah, I really enjoyed you coming here and appreciate your time, mate.
Yeah, thanks, Jack. And thank you, Gareth. It's wonderful to spend some time with two great ambassadors for boxing. And I wish you all the best for your future, Jack, and the same with you.